Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. True ramen lovers know that this Japanese-style noodle is more than a desiccated pouch found in college dorm rooms. Let me introduce you to the Ramaniac on the show today. One man's food journey from New York all the way to Rio by bicycle. We've been following the hungry cyclist for 2 years, and now we catch up with him at his final destination. What do certain foods do to your teeth? I cornered a dentist on what sodas and gum can do to our important oral tools. First, let's see what's in season this week at the area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Quinn Hatfield, who is a regular at the market. He's here every single week, of course, owner, chef of Hatfield's Restaurant. And as always, Quinn, we're interested to know what you're finding that's of interest to you and maybe give us an idea of how to prepare something great.
Well, I mean, right now we're doing a lot of beans, blue leg beans, yellow wax beans. The haricot verts are coming out really good right now.
Those nice flat ones.
Yeah, the yellow Romanos and green Romanos. We serve it with squid, but I think the main thing is just making sure you cook them in hot boiling water, good salt. Make sure you cook them enough. I like those beans to be cooked. It brings out the flavor in the beans.
Can you cook them all together, or don't they all have different cooking times?
Yeah, I think it's got to kind of do them one at a time, and you have to literally just pull one out and taste it and see if it's done or not. You know, I don't think there's any real time, you know, because some of them look the same and have totally different cooking times. You know, you kind of got to use your best judgment.
Okay, and then is it important to then put them in cold water right away or let them cool
right,
up? Okay.
Right into ice cold water. I mean, for the color, boiling water into ice water is going to help with the color.
Keep them nice and bright.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, so then at what end do you cut off? You cut off both the ends or just the stem end? You leave that little pointy end?
I cut them both off. But I think it would depend kind of on the application. I think the haricot verts look great with the little tip on them, you know, and maybe you just cut the stem off. But when you're doing a big mix, maybe it's easier just to take them, cut them, square them all off.
Right, and the haricot verts are the really skinny little tiny little French beans.
Right,
yeah.
And there's beautiful yellow and green this year, which are both amazing. So.
Wow. And then what do you do? Then you kind of toss them all together and do something
We glaze them with like onion puree and garlic puree and preserved lemon, but you could also make a simple vinaigrette, you know, that might fill that bill and be a little easier at home, you know, just olive oil and vinegar. And
when you say glaze them, are you putting them in a pan, reheating them and putting this stuff on, onion puree?
But I mean, but once you've got them cooked, I think you can, you know, you can sort of let it dictate. You can either do them room temperature or hot.
Fabulous.
As long as you cooked them right.
Right. And it's so sad that those beautiful purple beans turn green. Right. They never keep that color.
You're so excited when you get them. You're like, purple beans.
Yeah.
And then after they're cooked, you're like, where are the purple beans?
Yeah, I know. That's so great that you're taking advantage of the beans now because they are so good. People that buy beans at a grocery store have no idea how good a fresh bean is.
Right.
All right. Well, great. And tell us where your restaurant is.
Hatfield's restaurant is on Beverly at Gardner, which is between La Brea and Fairfax.
Okay. You can go to Hatfields.com and find out more about it.
Hatfieldsrestaurant.com.
Okay. Thank you. That was Quinn Hatfield. He's here every week at the market. We always see him. And this week he happens to be real stoked about the beans. We're visiting with P.Y. Pudwill now. She is, of course, the berry queen. She's got tons of berries all year round. Raspberries, all kinds of stuff. Today, though, I'm noticing you have these currants. And this is something new, relatively new, in your world of berries. And first of all, let's describe what they look like and how they taste and then what things people might use them for. Tell us a little bit about them.
Okay. Those are European fruits. And people use it for jelly and then maybe garnish, you know, like a decorate. And
Can you eat them raw? Can you just eat them? Okay.
Yeah. It's a taste really different. Then it's not sweet, but it's kind of a little bit sour flavor. Once you get used to it, it tastes good. And it's a very high vitamin C. It's more than orange or any kiwi, anything like that.
Now the two kinds you have,
I got three different kinds. I got black and champagne, and I got red.
Okay, these must be the champagne. They're like translucent, pale pink. They look like little pink marbles. And they grow on a cluster on a stem. Do you you have to like strip them all off the stem?
Yeah, it's like a grape. They hang down like a grape.
Yeah. Okay, and they all have probably distinct flavors. Each one is different.
Yeah, it's a different flavor. Yeah.
Okay, and what are most of the chefs doing with them, do you think? What do people do?
They do jelly and sauce, like a fishy sauce.
Oh, current sauce, yeah. And then you got these little half-pint baskets here. How much is one of these?
I'm selling $5 a basket for...
For a half-pint basket.
Half a pint, yeah.
And how long are you going to have them?
We have probably about 1.5 months.
Okay.
Yeah. Only produce once in a year.
Oh.
Yeah. Once you take it out and that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same vines?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seasons is more like the middle of June till probably end of July, I would say.
Oh, okay. So just about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, these are beautiful. And they're very heavy, so they're full of juice and...
Mm-hmm. You know, once you get used to this fruit... Oh, we love it.
Yeah, and because the other berries are all sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet.
This is a different flavor.
PY, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is interesting. The rest of your berries look
great today, too.
Okay. That was PY Pudwell. She has a very busy berry stand. She keeps us in raspberries and blueberries and blackberries all year round, and now she's got her 6 weeks of currants at the market. These are very gorgeous and fun to experiment with. You know, this is also the time of year. It's great. It's the middle of summer. All the melons are starting in, and there are so many new varieties, especially of the watermelons. So while you're out and about, be sure to save some room in your bag and in your refrigerator for some wonderful fresh melons at the market. They are delightful. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Once a month, I head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a video camera and cook up some of that farm fresh produce. The latest video cast is available now on our website. In it, I show you two surprising ways to prepare fresh porcini mushrooms. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to see these fat, delicious wild mushrooms and watch me cook them up in my backyard. How'd you like to go on an adventure today? There's a tour taking place today of Little Armenia in Hollywood at 2 o'clock. The tour is free. You'll see art, taste some Armenian food, and visit other Armenian sites. The tour is one of 5 tours of LA ethnic enclaves being offered as part of Trekking Los Angeles, Local Adventures in a Global City. You can go to lacommons.org to find out more. The tour begins at the Rose and Alex Pilibus School at Alexandria Avenue and Hollywood Boulevard at 2 o'clock today. It sounds like a lot of fun. Explore your city. I'll take you next on a trek for succulent pasta. It's made from duck eggs, and you have to call in advance to get the dish. You won't believe the taste. The location coming up next on Good Food. A dish that's getting a lot of attention around town. It's a special pasta that you can only get if you have inside information. Let me clue you into it. I found the executive chef of Blue on Blue restaurant at the Avalon Hotel in Beverly Hills. His name is Gabriel Gabreski, and he's on the line with me now. Hi, Gabriel.
How you doing?
The idea of just duck egg pasta, it must be incredibly rich. Could you give us some sort of idea of how rich it is, like the difference between it and regular pasta?
Well, it's the protein level in the yolk is a lot higher. So when we use it, you get a lot more fat to the pasta. So how I describe it to people is comparison to skim milk and then heavy cream.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, it's a big difference.
Does it have any different overtones than a chicken egg has?
Besides the richness, you get a little more of the egg flavor out, whereas I think nowadays a lot of the pasta is so much flour, and you have to kind of mask the pasta with so many different ingredients. With the duck egg, you really want the pasta to speak for itself, so we kind of keep it really simple in the preparation.
Now, what about the color of the final pasta? Is it more orangey, more yellow?
A lot more orange, yes.
Wow. Yeah. And when you're making the pasta, I don't mean to ask you to reveal any secrets you don't want to, but do you use the whole egg or do you just use the yolks?
We do a combination. We do primarily more yolk and then a little bit of white.
When you're actually working the dough in the kitchen, does it feel more silken?
It does. And it's what blows you away, really, is just the shine. when you're working that pasta, it's a cool test. I really recommend people do maybe a regular egg pasta and then the duck egg next to it, and just the color difference is amazing.
Do guests end up asking for it just plain?
Sometimes they do, because you just want to taste the pasta. We finish it with just a little butter and cheese.
That must be amazing.
Yes, it's a really popular dish.
So you started at the beginning to tell me how you're serving it now. Could you describe the dish?
It variates depending on the market every week, but lately we've been running it with morel mushrooms, fava beans, fresh butter, and then grated Parmesan.
Wow.
Yeah.
Give us an idea of what a duck egg looks like compared to a chicken egg.
The duck egg is a little bit larger. It has a thicker, like a harder shell, so it's not as easy, not as fragile. It's actually quite durable. You can sometimes drop it and it'll hold up. And it's got some very light splotches on it. But it also depends on the duck. I mean, we get duck eggs from several different people.
So is the dish available on your regular menu?
We don't have a consistent supplier for the eggs. So it kind of comes and goes depending on what's available at the market and our other sources.
Are your receptionists ready to have people call in and say, are you having the duck pasta tonight?
Yeah, you know, what we're trying to do is load up on the pasta, and, you know, some people are a little hesitant because it's like a little foreign for them, the whole duck concept. But the people that do try it, they're won over. They love the dish.
Thank you so much, Chef Gabriel. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
That was Chef Gabriel Gabreski from Blue on Blue Restaurant at the Avalon Hotel in Beverly Hills. We've been talking about duck egg pasta. Speaking of noodles, there's another variation that's consumed heavily in both college dorms and Japan. Of course, it's the ramen noodle. And if you think all ramen noodles are equal, you're about to change your mind. Up next, I'll introduce you to the Ramaniac, a man who has a goal to educate us all on the fine points of this beloved and comforting dish. That's when Good Food returns. Name the single most accessible meal for college students. I think it's ramen, those affordable bowls of dried up nothings that, with the addition of a little boiling water, become comforting, filling bowls of slurpiness. But ramen has quite a more serious pedigree. Rickman Wong is an LA resident and former English teacher in southern Japan, where he got his, quote, ramen training. He's now a self-proclaimed Ramaniac and chronicles his passion in his blog, Ramaniac.com. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to meet you and great to be here.
When you say the word ramen, to you, what are you thinking about? Is it just a bowl of broth and noodles?
I would say for me, it's the perfect food because it's so straightforward. Well, I mean, it's complex in the way in preparation and everything. It can be truly complex. But it's straightforward in that you've got a bowl, you've got soup, you've got noodles, and you've got toppings, and you've got all your food groups, all self-contained in this one perfect little dish that you can just eat quickly. And
yeah, it's like, to me, there are two parts of food like that. There's ramen or other kinds of noodle soups, and there's sandwiches. And they share a lot of the same perfect, comforting, completeness of appetite. Describe what ramen is as opposed to other kinds of noodle dishes.
Well, ramen is historically a Chinese soup noodles that came into Japan, and the Japanese kind of improved upon it or transformed it to make it more suitable for the Japanese palate.
And what did that involve?
Japanese food, for instance, like they use a lot of seafood or there's something called a dashi, like soup base and soup stock, and where they use like dried konbu or seaweed. Or bonito, which is like kind of like fish or like sardines. And they use that to make the soup base for a lot of things, like with udon and soba. But with ramen, they kind of fuse that with Chinese-style noodles. And they use that to make this dish, which is kind of a hybrid between Japanese and Chinese cuisine.
Does ramen have a different regional
theme that sort of runs through it? Does it change as you move from different parts of Japan to others?
Absolutely.
And do we have ramen here in LA that reflects those different styles?
There are increasingly starting to become a few places that do. Most places, they're pretty generic about it. There's a shoyu ramen, which is a ramen with a soy sauce soup base. There's a miso ramen, where they use a miso bean paste. And there's also shio ramen, which is a fairly new, but it's basically they just use salt as the base, and it's like a very light and clear soup.
Do the noodles always remain the same?
The noodles are very different depending on where you go. In southern Japan, they use thin white noodles that are cooked in a very al dente manner so that the ramen is very firm. In other parts of Japan, they use thick, curly noodles. In Yokohama, there's a style of ramen called ieke, and they use really thick, hearty noodles to go with the shoyu soup. And supposedly, the thick yellow noodles kind of grip the soup better and make it easier for slurping.
Are the yellow noodles egg-based and the white noodles just sort of simple, just wheat, starch, and water?
Essentially, what they use is there's something called kansui, which is sodium bicarbonate water, from my understanding. And it's from a certain lake in Mongolia. And they use that to make the noodles rise.
Wow.
And give it a certain kind of springiness. But often one of the complaints of Japanese people who come to America is that they can't get authentic Japanese ramen here because you can't import kansui into, like, the U.S.,
Oh, there must be some kind of water. There must be some kind of strange French mineral spa water that has that same. I have to, like, think now. Tell us a little bit about etiquette.
When it comes to ramen, actually, there's not all that much. It's one thing that's funny is that people, sometimes people, like, notice the slurping sound that ramen eaters are making with the ramen shops. And that's because it's perfectly okay and perfectly polite to slurp your noodles. That's actually how they kind of ideally say you should cool the broth, is just by slurping it up.
Just by taking in a little bit of air.
Just by taking in a bit of air and sucking it up. And then when you're finished with that and it's time to drink the soup, a lot of times people don't even use spoons. They just kind of hold the bowl up to their face and pour it down their throats.
When you like to eat here in Southern California and you're craving a dish of ramen that will bring you back to Japan, is there anywhere that you can think of that is really great?
The closest thing to quote-unquote authentic ramen is this place called Santoka Ramen. There are several of them, and they're in the food courts of the Japanese grocery store Mitsuwa. And there's one here in West LA on Pico, and there's one in Torrance and one in Costa Mesa. And their style of ramen is actually, it's called Asahikawa ramen, and it's from a town way in the north of Hokkaido, Japan, where they merge pork bone and seafood-based soup. And it's very rich and very hearty. And because it's from a cold area in Japan, they use a lot of oil in the soup to keep it hot, and which probably isn't the healthiest thing for you, but it's very, very tasty.
Has ramen permeated popular culture in Japan the way pasta has in Italy, where it sort of becomes almost like a caricature or a character?
Yeah, very much so. Ramen is a type of food that Japanese people are known to obsess over. So I would say there's like many ramaniacs in Japan, and they totally can out-eat me and seek out maybe hundreds of ramen places a year just to find like their favorite bowl or the best new shop.
And a true ramaniac, what do they or you think of the little dried packets?
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but when I was in college, I used to empty that into my 50-cent bowl of top ramen, and then I would lick the rest of the foil packet just to get that extra bit of sodium.
I love that. That's a different version of like ripping the lid off the yogurt. In Rome, there's a pasta museum. Is there a ramen museum in Japan?
There is. There's actually more than one. But the popular one is the Shin Yokohama Ramen Museum. They go through the history of noodles and instant noodles. And in the basement, there is something called a ramen stadium, where they have a rotating lineup of eight of the country's top ramen shops. And every month, people go there and they eat there at each of the different 8 shops, and they vote to see which shop is the most popular or which is the best for the month.
Well, that's so much fun. I love that. Thank you so much, Brickman. This has been great.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Romaniac.com is where to find Rickman Wong's reviews of ramen restaurants and other things. Lucky for us, he lives in L.A. How would you drive to get something to eat? How far would you go on a bike? My next guest traveled 14,724 miles to get a taste of the Americas. Good Food's been following the hungry cyclist for the past 2 years in his quest to eat his way across the USA and down to Rio. He made it. I catch up with him next on Good Food. Stay tuned. Heard of him when we've talked to him before, the hungry cyclist, Tom Kevel-Davies by name, who one day left London and spent months pedaling across America and then more months going down through Mexico, Central America to arrive at his final destination, Rio. Well, he's reached his goal, so I guess it's time to get some impressions of this monumental achievement. Hi, Tom. So where am I talking to you from?
I'm currently a little bit south of Rio de Janeiro in a small fishing village called Itamambuca.
How long have you been on the road?
It's just over 2 years now. I cycled out of New York in May 2005 and have been on the road since then, living in a tent living on a bicycle.
I mean, for most of us, we can't even imagine. We can maybe imagine the adventure of going on a summer holiday, going across a couple states and camping the whole way. But to make a commitment like this for 2 years, did you have any idea what you were really in for?
None whatsoever. yeah, I think I could probably count the nights I'd spent in a tent on one hand before I left. Something just kept pulling me onwards. I'm not sure what it was exactly. Really, just that what I was doing seemed like the best thing I could be doing at the time, and it has been just a tremendous adventure.
I know, reading the diary that you've been posting on your website, it sounded like the actual act of bicycling has been quite challenging in South America.
It has, yeah. I mean, I'm not naturally a very sporty person, and I think if I could have had the adventure in some other way than pedaling, I would have taken it. But I honestly believe that the adventure that a bicycle gives you is completely unique. And cycling in Brazil, you know, is very tough. In northern Brazil, it is incredibly hot. You know, you're on the equator, and it's an incredibly poor part of the world. It's just very tough on body and mind.
Could you give us just a little picture of where you were during Carnival? And what form your celebration took?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping to be somewhere a little more kind of substantial. Most people go to Rio or Salvador for Carnival, but I found myself in a small village in the state of Pará, which is one of Brazil's poorest states in northern Brazil, which probably had a population of about 2,000. And a kind family took me in and, you know, said you should spend Carnival with us. And the first evening, we sat down for dinner. They produced a delicious stew, which I then asked what meat it was. And my Portuguese was very slim at that stage. But we couldn't kind of conclude what the animal was until one of the children came in clutching a kind of fat armadillo. So my carnival got underway with a delicious bowl of armadillo stew. And then I had an incredibly special time with the people of Cachoeira, a small town in Pará.
This aspect of getting sort of momentarily kidnapped by locals, I would imagine that on a trip of your kind, that would be sort of the highlight and a necessity on your trip.
Completely. You know, I think if you travel on a bus or on a train or in a car, you go from A to B. But the joy of being on a bicycle is that you see everything, the world that exists between A and B. And invariably, the kindness of the people you meet along the way and the hospitality they show you, especially in Latin America and in North America too, has made the trip.
In the course of going through Brazil, you were on some boats or ferries or barges going down the river in very, very rough conditions. But you met some interesting culinary folks.
I got onto the Amazon in Ecuador, on the Ecuadorian-Colombian border, which in itself is a quite sketchy part of the world. And there I had to wait in a small village for 3 days for the boat that would take me downstream to Peru, which was a week. And the boat itself was really just a cargo boat that went between the small jungle communities, collecting bananas, pigs, buffaloes, chickens, ducks, and anything else that they were kind of, you know, hoping to sell in the markets of Iquitos. You know, I had my hammock with me, and I just had to find a spot above the chickens and the buffalo and the pigs and the other various kind of smelly things. And for a week, we went downstream. And the food, I have to say, was just horrific. It was cooked by a man who I saw kind of wrestling pigs from the bank of the river onto the boat, who also half the time was kind of elbows deep in the oily engine, and hygiene wasn't at the top of his list of priorities. And he would each day kind of hack a duck to pieces and cook it in a pot with rice and river water. And it was, you know, I mean, I was very, very hungry. And even then, I really had to force myself to eat this stuff. But the joy of the trip was that every now and then we'd stop in these small village communities, and women and children would rush onto the boat while we were stopped for a few hours, while they kind of tried to get buffalo to walk onto the boat. And they'd sell us these strange fruits and fish, you know, which I'd never seen before, which are the, you know, the fruits of the Amazon. For me, the kind of culinary heart of Brazil is the state of Bahia, in the center of the country. And Bahia has very interesting food because it was an important post for the slave trade. And so in Bahia, you have this incredible mix of African and Angolan cooking and things like the moqueca, which is a fish stew made with dende oil and coconut milk, and the acarajé, which are deep-fried white bean balls, if you like, filled with spicy shrimp, and vatapá, which is another shrimp paste. And, you know, that for me, that's very interesting to see that the cultural crossover that the history has provided there.
So what are you most anxious to eat once you get home to England?
Well, my mother's cooking is superb, and she's already asked me what I'd like to eat on my first evening back with my family. I've asked for a leg of lamb. Lamb is quite hard to find in Latin America. And then my father makes a very good creme brulee, so I've asked for that for dessert. So hopefully when I get back, that'll be waiting for me.
Now, what were you doing? What was your profession before you left?
I was a graphic designer for a small advertising agency in London.
And what do you anticipate doing when you go back? Are you going to turn this all into a book?
I would love to turn this journey into a book.
So how are you getting back?
I'm flying back. Initially, I had thoughts of sailing back, but that proved very difficult.
Well, I wish you a not-too-hard re-entry, and I'll be anxious to talk to you once you've been home for a while.
It would be great to speak to you again.
Thank you so much, Tom.
My pleasure.
You'll have to keep in touch with Tom Keville-Davies to see what's next. We've got links to his site on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. We all know what too much junk food can do to our waistlines, but what does all that soda and snacks like gum do to our teeth? I found a dentist to ask how it looks from inside the mouth. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with chewing gum. It got to the point, and I know this is a little gross, that before I went to bed, I would take the large pink wad from my mouth and plunk it into a glass of water, where it would rest until I woke up the next morning and popped it back into my mouth. But what does gum chewing do to our teeth and jaws? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? For the answer, we've turned to dentist Nancy Short.
Gum in general has some benefits, and just things like it's a good stress reducer. Nicorette, smokers can use it, or just if they want to have something to chew instead of smoke. It's good for dieting somewhat. It's good for people that have had medical problems, or they're on medications that lower their saliva, like radiation does that.
And what about what it does to our saliva? Is producing more saliva in our mouths a good thing?
Yes, because saliva, what it does is it buffers the acids. Tooth decay and damage to the teeth really is all about acids and the bacteria that produce it and the bacteria that can metabolize sugars. And sucrose is just the mother of all acid-producing problems in the mouth.
So one of the worst things to do would be to chew sugared gum.
Sugared gum, and then quit chewing rapidly so that you constantly are bathing your teeth in sugar. It turns out if you chewed it for maybe 15 minutes and got the saliva to sort of wash some of the sugar away, that wouldn't be quite as bad. But there are some tooth regenerating materials out now. One is called xylitol, and what that does is that blocks bacteria that causes decay.
So if we see a gum that says xylitol on it, we should choose that.
I think you should. It's moderation in all things. It turns out if you have something like over 40 grams of xylitol, you end up it's a laxative. So it's not something you want to chew, 24/7. But say you're out at a business meeting and you've just had some gooey thing that someone served you, one of the best things to do would be to pop a xylitol gum.
And what about the whole aspect of our jaws? What does chewing do for our hinge? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, people come in and they'll say, I have TMJ. And, well, everybody has TMJ because that's the name of the joint, actually. So TMJ isn't the disease. TMD is actually temporal mandibular dysfunction. But if you tell people I have TMD, they won't know what you're talking about.
And what is that?
Usually, if you're talking about it connected with gum, it's where people have been chewing just too much. It turns out for the day, you generally chew 20 minutes. And that's because as you're eating, you put down the fork, you talk, you pick up things, you cut things.
So it's the addition of all those extra minutes and hours of chewing.
Correct, yeah. If you're chewing like 6 hours a day, you can imagine
it's
the,
like
the
stress on a muscle.
You're overdoing. The TMJ has a little cartilage disc. It's kind of like your knee in the sense you have the little patella and the little disc and the little cartilage in there to keep things smooth. And what happens is you people start hearing popping and clicking, and maybe it's not even painful, but it's because the joint has just been overworked and the little disc that's supposed to protect things is starting to get kind of worn and distraught.
Gosh, that doesn't sound good. What else is bad for chewing? We all remember that vivid science project that many of us did as children where the tooth was put into the glass of Coca-Cola and disintegrated over time.
Right. It turns out that sodas, unfortunately, are replacing milk to our young people. And it's not just the sugars when you look at the different sodas. But when you take the sugar out, it turns out that you don't always have that much more of a benefit because there's acids in the sodas. And the acids alone can cause a lot of damage. So especially citric acid and the phosphoric acid that's in the soda. So you can end up with decalcification, where the calcium's leached out of the tooth and soft spots in the enamel, which can add to, number one, what people get most upset of course, staining nowadays. They want white teeth. But number two, you can end up with weak spots in the enamel that from the acids, the citric acid, like Mountain Dew, 7-Up, those kind of drinks.
So if somebody's really addicted to certain types of sodas, it might be good to add a gum with xylitol to their daily chewing.
Well, hopefully they would, it's moderation in all things. That's what we felt bored with when we were kids, hearing it from our parents.
Are there different things in, for example, cola drinks and the citrus drinks that make one better or worse for the teeth?
Well, the cola drinks stain more, but the citrus drinks, the citric acid that's added to make the lemon-lime flavor is pretty tough on the enamel too. So that alone with even its diet was causing chalkier look to the teeth than with the sugar, actually.
In your opinion, what's the number one food that causes tooth decay?
Well, it would have to be sucrose. You know, corn syrup is in so many things.
So, you know that old Trident commercial where it was like 4 out of 5 dentists agree? Did
yes.
they really?
Well, we don't really talk about chewing gum that often. And when we do, usually it is related to the problems where people overdo it. So most dentists I don't encourage people to chew gum because I just figure I'm going to hear back. My friend told me that you want your patients to chew gum. And then I would end up hearing, well, now I have a jawache. So it's not a major food group, you know. So the back to the moderation in all things. It's a nice thing to do. But I don't recommend xylitol a lot either, you know, chewing gum, just because of the fact that it has that laxative effect overly. And I don't like to see little kids chewing gum.
Thanks a lot, Nancy.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Nancy Short is a dentist in practice in Brentwood. We've been talking about the damaging effects of sodas and other teeth issues. Martha's Vineyard is an island off the coast of Massachusetts that becomes a vacation paradise between Memorial Day and Labor Day. It's a charming place where the Kennedys have a compound and other of America's elite claim second homes as well. The island also has a rich legacy of African American tradition and home ownership. I'll be back with the stories of Oak Bluffs when Good Food continues. I seem to have these little clumps of friends who grew up outside of L.A., and they spend a part of each summer in Martha's Vineyard. Having never had the pleasure, I've always wondered what culinary traditions are created by people who take their culinary favorites and add in an overlay of fabulous seafood. Since noted culinary historian and author Jessica Harris knows great food, and she's summered on the vineyard for some 50-something years, I've asked her to share some culinary stories of the African-American community Oak Bluffs, sometimes called the Inkwell. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, but I've got to correct you a little bit. The Inkwell is the name of our town beach. It was one given sort of to us and by us, and it was never the name of the community.
Thank you so much for that correction. Let me ask you, did you start summering in the vineyard when you were a child?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been summering here for, I think this summer is actually my 50th summer. So it's been a long, lovely tenure of summers.
Now, when did African Americans start to create yearly summer communities there?
Well, it's a longer history than most people think. And one of the things that's been very interesting about it is the community of African Americans goes back well into the 19th, and there were even African Americans on the island in the 18th century. But the summer community seems to be more of a 20th century thing.
And describe a little bit about where on the island the community is located and give us sort of a description. What is it like? What do the houses look like?
The one that is known as being the area where the majority of African Americans have traditionally had summer homes is the town called Oak Bluffs. Oak Bluffs began its history in the mid to late 19th century as kind of a Chautauqua, you know, one of the places where people would get together for camp meetings in the summer, and there would be preaching and, you know, holding forth, and then folks would come from their various churches or even with their church groups and settle in a common area. That was white folks. That was not the black people. The black people came sort of parallel and tangential to that. And later, the African Americans set up their own communities. So the town of Oak Bluffs was originally called Cottage City, because the folks who came for the Chautauqua was first settled in tents, and then the tents got built into cottages. So if you see the town today, it's wonderful, filled with not sort of, you know, grand Victorian mansions, although we certainly have some of those, but filled more with gingerbread cottages because they have Carpenter Gothic, all of the fretwork and the carved wood around them.
So describe for me what some of the feasting that you've had over the years has contained.
Goodness, it's everything from, you know, clam bakes on the beach, which is a tradition. There is an organization up here of African-American women. My mother was a member. They are known as the Cottagers, and every year they have an annual clam bake. Dig a pit, the lobsters, the clams, the corn, the potatoes, occasional mussels and stuff. So that's one grand meal that always means summertime. To me, summer always means scallops. And certainly scallops cooked in any number of ways. In Massachusetts, certainly the Bay Area is noted for its scallops, the Bay scallops. There's nothing sweeter.
Do you, like, go down to a dock and get scallops straight from fishermen?
Well, I don't get them straight from the fishermen. I go to the local fish market and get them there, and I also have been known to order them in restaurants. I tend to like mine deep fried.
Is there a lot of deep frying of seafood that goes on there?
There's a fair amount. I mean, there are, you know, your traditional New England sort of clam bar, lobster shack. In fact, there's even a fish shop where you can go and they will boil your lobster to order. And you can sit and eat it on the lobster crates and watch them bring in the catch for the next day.
Do you ever get tired of eating lobster?
I don't eat lobster, actually.
Oh, I love that. Why not?
I'm allergic to it. That's my best-kept culinary secret. But I cook lobster, and I cook lobster for my friends. So
how do you do it?
If I'm just making straight lobster, is I will put a can of beer in with the lobster. But generally speaking, I think lobster is just pretty darn wonderful as it is.
When the African-American community really started to come into its own there on the vineyard, was a lot of the food a combination of foods that were being eaten in various parts of the states where people came from mixed with the seafood?
I think one of the things that happened is, you know, we brought our culinary traditions with us. So fried chicken certainly became a part of the summer, deviled eggs, potato salad, coleslaw, all of the fixings of a good southern feast. The island corn is beyond peer. It is just to die for. You get okra on the island, and so there are all sorts of, you know, people from Louisiana and the Gulf area will do their gumbos. Other folks may just do a southern succotash of okra, corn, and tomatoes. And I've got tomato plants in the backyard, and they've got some beautiful green globes that may end up being fried green tomatoes if I can't wait. And if I can wait, they'll be fabulous in a salad in another couple of weeks.
And you mentioned a nice summer succotash. Walk us through that dish that you make.
Okay, well, a summer succotash is a really simple thing. It's just okra, corn, and tomatoes. You get the tomatoes. I like to peel them and seed them just as a little finesse. You don't have to worry about that. Corn, cut off the cob, okra. I use a habanero chili. Now, everybody can't use a habanero chili. Some people will prefer a jalapeno, and some people may prefer no chili at all. But I like to put the habanero in and just prick it with a fork. That way it won't explode and get all over everything. And you can lift it out when the succotash is as hot as you'd like it.
And what kind of fat do you sauté in?
I don't sauté. I put it all together. I add a little bit of water, and I just simmer it.
Mm. For how long?
It doesn't take long, about 15 minutes, or, you know, till you know, my favorite thing that I wish I could write a cookbook called is just cook it till it's done.
I know. That's my favorite thing. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking some time out of your summery day to share with us what your life is like a little bit there on the vineyard.
Well, thank you so much. And you got to come and see us one day.
I would love to. That was Jessica Harris. She's a noted culinary historian who specializes in tracing the African-American and other African cuisines. We will have a link to a list of her books on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's ice cream season. Well, the season when we admit to eating ice cream. There are many different styles, of course. So next, I'll give you the scoop of French-style ice cream from a famed expat pastry chef living in France. That's coming up on Good Food.
Mm-hmm.
It's no great surprise to anyone that listens to this show that my favorite food group is ice cream. Yet I've not ventured deeply into the terrain of making ice cream at home. Now that famed pastry chef David Leibovitz has paved the way, maybe it's time to finally commit to cranking that churn. David is talking to us today from Paris, his home. Hi, David.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. How hard is it to really make incredibly excellent ice cream?
Well, I would say these days anybody can spend less than $50 for a machine and turn out great ice cream, as good if not better than what you can buy, because when you make it yourself, you control the ingredients and you can add whatever you want.
Now, my experience with ice cream is that fresh out of the churn, it's always amazing, but once I freeze it, it never is the same. Why does that happen sometimes?
Well, that's because our home freezers are designed to freeze things like chicken stock and peas and other things, and they're not meant to freeze homemade ice cream, which is very dense, very compact. When you make it yourself, it doesn't have any air or anything bad in it. It's all pure ingredients, so it's going to freeze a lot harder. I've listed a bunch of techniques, actually, in the book on how to prevent that from happening. But one of them is to add alcohol to your ice cream.
That's interesting.
Because alcohol doesn't freeze, as you know, for those of you that keep vodka bottles in your freezer for parties or for whatever.
Even adding a little bit of alcohol will help maintain a creamy texture?
Absolutely. To about a quart of ice cream, you can add up to 3 tablespoons of liquor. You can add something complimentary, like if you make an orange Szechuan pepper ice cream.
Oh, yeah, just to say.
Well, it's really easy. If I can do it, anybody can do it in my little tiny Parisian kitchen.
Actually, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, you know, just to mention some of the absolutely, like, mouth-watering flavors. Pear pecorino ice cream.
Gelato.
Yeah, the orange Szechuan pepper, the many lemon ones. You seem very fascinated with working with lemon and ice cream.
People really like lemon, and I do too, especially with something like ice cream, because ice cream can tend to be quite rich. But I tend to like desserts that are very clean flavored, very fresh tasting, and lemon is one of those things that it's always welcome after dinner. I don't know anybody that doesn't like lemon.
Can you describe what the difference is between a sherbet and a sorbet and a granita?
Well, there's no official legal definition, but a granita is basically a shaved ice. A sorbet is generally pure fruit. There's no dairy in it. It's usually fruit and sugar and perhaps some flavoring like a liqueur. Whereas in sherbet, there often is dairy. You can add milk, sometimes cream. A sherbet has a lot of flavor because there's very little fat, there's very little egg yolks. It's more about the fruit or about the chocolate. It's a chocolate coconut sherbet, which has coconut milk in it. I think people have this image of lime green sherbet from their cousin's wedding in New Jersey, served in a fresh fruit cup with a swan boat. I think it's kind of icky, but you can make wonderful lemon buttermilk sherbet with no special equipment, just an ice cream machine. And you don't even need that.
So give us the idea of the difference of the initial starting techniques for an ice cream and a sherbet.
Well, there's two kinds of ice cream. One is a custard-based, which is French style, which is very appropriate since I live in France. And the other is Philadelphia style, which is basically milk or cream with some sort of flavoring added. Whereas a sherbet is sort of made the same way, basically. It's ingredients stirred or blended together.
When we think of gelato, is that a custard-based ice cream?
Well, gelato is very controversial because, as you know from being an expert on Italian food, it depends where you are in Italy. But in general, Italians don't put eggs in gelato. I'll start getting lots of emails from Italians saying, I put eggs in gelato.
So give us a few just hints and techniques.
Well, I think one of them is to use good ingredients. When you're making a strawberry frozen yogurt, get good strawberries. You know, go to the market, lift all the baskets to your nose, take a big sniff, which if you live in America, you can do. In France, they'll slap you.
Well, what about the milk itself? I mean, here, so much of the milk we're getting is of the ultra-pasteurized variety.
Well, I think it is. The first thing you should do is write to your local representative and complain about the quality of dairy.
And then start to make the ice cream.
And that's going to be in the next edition of the book. It's going to be a form letter that people can rip out and send to their local congressperson. It sounds cliche, and it's been drilled into our heads, is to use good ingredients. But that's the beauty of making things for yourself. You can buy incredible, you know, artisanal American chocolate nowadays and use that, and you have, you know, mind-blowingly good chocolate ice cream.
So we start with fabulous ingredients. And what kind of churn did you use to test a lot of these ingredients?
Actually, I used three different kinds of ice cream machines. But since I was churning up, you know, 5, 6, 7 batches of ice cream a day, I bought one of the machines that has a freezer in it. And I'm actually going to do an article for my blog about how to make ice cream without a machine pretty soon, because that's another thing, is ice cream was invented before the ice cream machine, and people can make ice cream at home by just stirring it up in the freezer.
Wow, yum.
Yeah, look at Sicily. They made granita.
Yeah, they did. And, of course, you can always buy one of those things that you see in one of those airplane magazines where you put the ingredients in a ball and kick it around.
Well, you know, the problem with those, I haven't used one because I think in France people would look at me funny if I started tossing a ball of custard around the street.
Well, David, I want to thank you once again for embracing a subject totally.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Evan. And I'm glad you liked the book.
Oh, what? Now, isn't that perfect? I love that sound.
What, the fire department in the background?
Yeah.
Aye.
That was David Leibovitz. His new book is The Perfect Scoop. David keeps a blog about chocolate and other elements of a pastry lover's palate. Find a link to his site on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. I want to tell you next about a couple of people who've turned their reverence of meat into a magazine. It's called Meat Paper, and the staff is paid in prosciutto. More on this mini meat economy when Good Food continues. If you're a conscious person, the question of meat in our society hangs there, begging to be discussed. It's so fundamental, and the questions surrounding it are often metaphors for other aspects of our lives. So I was fascinated to discover a new magazine called Meat Paper, a journal of meat culture. Meat Paper explores some deep questions through art and thoughtful articles. Amy Standen is a full-time producer at KQED, the San Francisco NPR station. She founded Meat Paper along with her friend, Sasha Wisansky. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So tell me a little bit about how the idea for Meat Paper was born.
The idea for Meat Paper was actually born in the brain of Sasha Wisansky, just to give credit where credit is due. Sasha's an artist and a designer, and had noticed that she was seeing a lot of artists who were using meat as both a medium and also as a subject, a theme for their work. This was at the same time that we were starting to see a lot of books, you know, people like Michael Pollan and the book Fast Food Nation, you know, these books that were coming out exploring our relationship to meat and a new kind of consciousness about what we're eating. She brought me on about a year and a half ago as sort of someone with more of a magazine editorial background to help out with that aspect of things. And since then, this has become a real sort of passion for both of us, something we're really excited about.
Are you meat eaters or are you vegans?
That's what everyone wants to know. We are both meat eaters. I've gone through vegetarian periods in my life, but I'm not in one now. I'm definitely a conflicted, sort of an ambivalent meat eater.
Give us a picture of Issue Zero. Describe what some of the articles are.
Sure. issue zero is a great sort of, I think, snapshot of what the magazine will look like in that it's really all over the map. We have an artist named Mike Arcega who built a world map of spam. And so we have an image of that project of his. And let's see, we have a story by an architecture professor who writes about sort of the similarities between the island of Manhattan and a cut of beef in terms of how each body is broken up into different parts. And you have sort of urban planning often tends to mimic butchery and terms that butchers use. You see this, of course, in San Francisco, too, with the Tenderloin District. We have a conversation between somebody who is a really sort of unapologetic meat eater and somebody else who is a very conflicted meat eater. And they're sort of going back and forth about sort of the philosophical thinking behind what it means to eat meat. We have a beautiful series of photographs, something we're really excited about, from a guy named John Caserta, who's a photographer that spent a year in a very rural small town in Italy documenting, among other things, a traditional pig slaughter there. And he has these photographs that are...
they're amazing. They look almost like Dutch master's paintings.
Yeah, they really
very
do.
Fascinating. When this first hit the internet, what have the responses been? And did you find that it was much easier to create the kind of structure you need for a magazine with the advertisers and subscribers that you need to keep that going from this issue zero?
We've had a lot of, you know, people look at the magazine, I think half the time they think we are these radical, vegan, you know, virulent anti-meat people. And the other half of the time they look at us and they think that we are these sort of, I'm a red meat eater and proud of it, sort of Ted Nugent types. And then they take a closer look and they realize that actually neither of those things is true, that we sort of include all of those camps and many more things as well.
I know that during this whole development period, you have had zero budget for contributors. Tell us how you're paying your contributors.
Sure. We pay contributors in salami, and that's either vegan salami, which exists, or pork salami.
Can you give us a little sneak preview of some of the items that will be in issue one?
Sure. We have an article about one of the sort of earliest and most sort of seminal pieces of meat art, which is a work that was called Meat Dress by an artist named Jana Sterbach, which was a dress made of meat that actually caused quite a sensation when that first came out. She's a Canadian artist. And tying that to some 17th century Dutch art involving meat, you find that meat has been a loaded cultural symbol. I mean, going way, way, way back into art history, it's one of the oldest cultural sort of artistic symbols. We have an interview with a woman named Loretta Oden, who's a Native American chef, who talks about how Native Americans hunted and used bison, they used different parts of the animal for. She also, a little tease, she's going to give us a recipe for how to cook beaver tail. very useful recipe to have around.
Well, Amy, we really look forward to continuing to have conversations with you, and we wish you a great deal of luck and congratulations on Meat Paper.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
That was Amy Standen. She, along with her friend Sasha Wisansky, have started a new magazine called Meat Paper. You can go onto our website at kcrw.com/goodfood to look for a link to their site and subscription information. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, download Good Food, and watch video episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. Music supervisor is Gary Masiha, and very special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.